Thank you for the kind welcome. Thank you for the invitation to the university. It is my first visit to Turkey. I'm most pleased to come here. I have a, you might say, a long-distant relation with Turkey, in that my mother's brother was one of the unfortunate, sad, poor Australian soldiers who was sent here to invade your country in 1917, and my mother's brother was killed at Gallipoli. That's the sad part. The more pleasant part is that I learned just a couple of days ago in Istanbul that May 19 is an important date for Turkey, the beginning of the Turkish liberation struggle, commemorated as the Turkish Youth Day. Well, May 19 is an important day for me, and it's the reason that I have to leave Turkey tomorrow in order to be home by May 19, because May 19 is my own birthday. So that's the happy part of my connection with Turkey. As mentioned, what I will be talking on is the contribution of history and philosophy of science to science teaching and research. In 1994, I published a book, Science Teaching, The Role of History and Philosophy of Science. And in the introduction of that book, I laid out, you might say, a program for my own research in the field. And what's on the slide, and the slide, all of the slides or the file will be sent to you if you so request. In the introduction of the book, I said that for all its faults, the scientific tradition has promoted rationality and critical thinking and objectivity. It instills a concern for evidence and for having ideas judged not by personal or social interest, but by how the world is. A sense of cosmic piety, as Bertrand Russell called it. The vitality of the scientific tradition and its positive impact on society depends upon children being successfully introduced to its achievements, methods and thought processes by teachers who have understood and value science. The history and philosophy of science contributes to this understanding and valuation. I wrote that in 1994, and of course it's still my own position. One of the advantages, you might say, of philosophy is that things change very slowly in philosophy, and philosophical positions once attained normally stay that way or change or modify slightly. This is unlike other fields. I recall being at a farewell celebration for an economics teacher at the high school where my own daughter went, and they brought in to give the speech to the economics teacher who was retiring, they brought in a famous economist to give the speech. And the economist said that when he was teaching, he was very pleased that he was an economist, because he could set the same exam paper every year, unlike the science teachers who have to think up new questions every year. And he said that in economics, you can set the same exam question every year because every year the answers change. Philosophy is not like that. Well, three areas of application. Philosophy of science and history of science, I believe, are relevant to, first, theoretical issues that science teachers have to deal with and that science curriculum writers deal with and science examiners deal with. There are many theoretical issues. I've listed just some. These will ring bells with people depending on how much studies of science education you've done. Constructivism, multiculturalism, feminism, religion, worldviews, models, ethics. I'll elaborate some of those in a while, but you only have to mention the words to realise that you can't talk very sensibly about these things without some understanding of philosophy, philosophy of science, and history of science. HPS is relevant to curriculum construction, the inclusion of nature of science in curriculum. Again, the immediate thing is, if you have nature of science in the curriculum, well, what is the nature of science? And my point for all of these things is that you can't answer that question without some knowledge of or interest in history and philosophy of science. And attempts at making integrative curricula, integrative both within subjects, within science, and also between subjects. And I will elaborate some of that later. And finally, HPS is relevant to pedagogical or classroom concerns. Philosophy in the classroom, historical investigative teaching, and integrative curriculum. I will mention some of these things. Well, the first area of theoretical connection is with constructivism. To quote a prominent Australian researcher, Peter Fensham, well known in the philosophy, in the science education world, Peter Fensham wrote, "The most conspicuous psychological influence on curriculum thinking in science since 1980 has been the constructivist view of learning. The maturity and robustness of what has evolved in science education research is a result of the combination of alternate conceptions with constructivist views of learning." Two people, Davis and Samara, who wrote on this topic of the influence of constructivism, wrote, "An interesting pattern emerged in our searches of the ERIC database. Considered across the past three decades, the numbers of items that come up on a search for constructivist or constructivism follow a pattern of smooth exponential growth. In the early 1970s, the number of records were in the single digits. By the early 1980s, the numbers had increased to two digits, then to three digits in the early 1990s. In 2000, the numbers passed 1,000. As to the quantities of materials intended for or developed by practicing teachers, a sense of their proliferation might be gleaned from the internet, where the hits for constructivism plus education number in the tens or hundreds of thousands, depending on the search engine used." 10 years ago, Catherine Toomey Fosnott commented on US education reforms that most recent reforms advocated by national professional groups are based on constructivism. For example, the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics, the National Science Teachers Association, and so on. Well, all of what they're saying is quite true, in that constructivism has had a big international impact on curricula and curriculum writers. It's been adopted as the official educational philosophy in Ontario, Canada, in Thailand, Greece, New Zealand, some areas of the USA, India, and in fact, as I've learned recently, in Turkey. Turkish science and technology curriculum, 6th, 7th and 8th grades. Most of you would be familiar with this document. In the field of education, especially science education, studies have provided findings that illustrate how students learn science and what conditions support the learning of science. When these findings are considered, a need for new approaches for the teaching and learning process, learning context and teaching strategies to achieve the program goals will be noticed. Teaching strategies and learning experience should in all possible cases be guided by the constructivist learning approach for students to achieve the goals stated in the program, and also the learning context and teaching strategy should reflect the constructivist approach as much as possible. That's the Turkish National Curriculum Document. And it goes on, constructivist learning approach, emphasise individuals, do not start, etc., etc. The principles that are put forth by the constructivist learning approach provide important clues for developing a more effective learning approaches. This approach, constructivism, asserts that information cannot be directly transferred to students from teachers, but it would be effectively reconstructed and transformed in a new format. Well, constructivism has had a big influence, both in educational research and, as I've tried to indicate, in educational practice by its adoption in many, many countries. Well, what is it? Constructivism began as a theory of learning, first with Piaget, developed into what's called personal constructivism, Vygotsky, the Soviet scholar, developed into what's become known as social constructivism, and Jerome Bruner, and developed into what is called cognitive constructivism. Constructivism expanded into, it moved from a theory of learning into a theory of what is learned, that is, a theory of knowledge. It expanded into a theory of knowledge and then expanded indeed into other wider domains. From learning theory to epistemology. You see this in the writing of Fosner that I cited earlier. Constructivism is a theory about knowledge and learning. Constructivism is a theory about knowledge and learning. It describes both what knowing is and how one comes to know, based on work in psychology, philosophy, science, and biology. I won't elaborate. The point here is that you see in constructivist writing a move from, on the one hand, a theory of learning into a theory of knowledge, epistemology. And epistemology is a philosophical position, not a psychological position. How people learn things is a psychological matter. The status of what they learn, the truth status of what they learn, is a philosophical matter. I won't elaborate more. You can read that later in your own time. Constructivism begins as a theory of learning, it becomes a theory of personal knowledge, a theory of scientific knowledge, a theory of teaching or instruction. There's a move from constructivism as an account of how children learn to an account of how teachers should teach. That is a theory of pedagogy. Then a theory of education, and with some writers it becomes a whole view of life or worldview. Well, there are two problems with constructivism. I'll deal mainly with the first. The first problem is philosophical problems, namely, it's bad philosophy, in my view. Its epistemology is subjectivist and relativist, and both subjectivism and relativism are simply inconsistent with science. The second philosophical problem with constructivism is ontological. Constructivism ontologically is idealist, and idealism is inconsistent with science. I'll mention briefly a second area of problems with constructivism, not so much philosophical but pedagogical. The pedagogical problem with constructivism is namely a fairly simple one. Namely, constructivist teaching techniques simply don't work. When children are taught constructively, they don't learn. And inasmuch as they do learn when they're taught constructively, they learn because teachers depart from constructivist principles. Well, these are big claims, and as we all big claims in philosophy, many big claims in philosophy are simply wrong. And my big claims might also be wrong, but that's for you to decide. Peter Fincham. Fincham, in his book Defining an Identity, which is an account of the discipline of science education, interviewed 80 leading science educators around the world, and what came out of these interviews is that people said that the chief philosophical influences on them were Thomas Kuhn, Ernst von Glasersfeld, David Bloor, and Bruno Latour. All of these people identified as chief philosophical influences on the leading science educators, all of them are constructivists. The people interviewed, I've listed some of them, for those familiar with science education research, the names will all be pretty much familiar. These names are all familiar and listed among them are, you know, people who have awards as the most cited science educators and on and on and on. In other words, Fincham's pool of 80 was, by and large, an accurate pool. These were the top science educators in the world. And the story that comes from them is, yes, they're constructivists and their philosophical influences are constructivists. Fincham states that Ernst von Glasersfeld's many writings on personal constructivism have had a very widespread influence on researchers in science education. In their published research, he is regularly cited as a general source for constructivist learning. He is a person who has had the most significant influence on science education. Well, Ernst von Glasersfeld, what sorts of things does he say? The person who was regarded by Fincham and others as, you know, the most important influence on science education, what are his philosophical positions? For constructivists, the word knowledge refers to a commodity that's radically different from the objective representation of an observer-independent world. Instead, knowledge refers to conceptual structures that epistemic agents, given the range of present experience within their tradition of thought and language, consider viable. Again, von Glasersfeld, the key idea that sets constructivism apart from other theories of cognition was launched about 60 years ago by Jean Piaget. It was the idea that what we call knowledge does not and cannot have the purpose of producing representations of an independent reality, but instead has an adaptive function. This changed assessment of cognitive activity entails an irrevocable break with the generally accepted epistemological tradition of Western civilization, according to which the knower must strive to attain a picture of the real world. Most philosophers hang on to the belief that the progress of science will somehow lead to an approximation of the ultimate truth. Most philosophers hang on to the belief, well, myself, I hang on to that belief. Von Glasersfeld simply turns his back on it. The other side of constructivist philosophy is its ontological position. On the one hand, there's epistemology. What is knowledge? And for the constructivists, at least you might say the hardcore constructivists, what is knowledge? It's not something that relates to the external world in the sense of relating truly or correctly or even approximately to the external world. Knowledge is simply something, ideas that are viable given our experience. Well, the other side of constructivist philosophy is ontology. Again, von Glasersfeld, for the constructivist, there are no structures other than those which the knower constitutes by his very own activity of coordination of experiential particles. there are no structures, what I should put in there, no structures in the world other than what the knower constitutes. So atoms don't have structure. We create a structure for atoms. The Earth doesn't have structure. We create a structure for the Earth. The biological world doesn't have structure. We create the structure. Radical constructivism, thus, is radical because it breaks with convention and develops a theory of knowledge in which knowledge does not reflect an object of ontological reality, but exclusively an ordering, an organisation of a world constituted by our experience. The radical constructivist has relinquished metaphysical realism once and for all. Well, again, myself, I'm a metaphysical realist. Constructivists have relinquished that position. I should say I'm not the only metaphysical realist around either. There are a number of us, although we might be dying out. Constructivism and ontology. Another example, John Strader, one of the people interviewed. John is a personal friend of mine, former president of NAST, former secretary of the NAST group, altogether a nice fellow. Staver writes, for constructivists, observations, objects, events, data, laws and theory do not exist independently of observers. The lawful and certain nature of natural phenomena are properties of us, those who describe, not of nature that is described. Again, just think or read slowly. For constructivists, observations, objects, events, data, laws, and theory do not exist independently of observers. Objects don't exist independently of observers. So this lectern doesn't exist independently of you looking at it and me tapping on it. And when you cease to look and I cease to tap, according to Staver, this does not exist. This is a pretty wild position. Further, events don't exist independently of observers. When a tree falls down, if no one's looking, then the event didn't happen. Events can't have happened before, you know, there were observers. So events in the Earth, in the distant past, that paleontologists and geomorphologists and others are trying to study, well, these events didn't happen because there were no observers. The lawful and certain nature of natural phenomena are properties of us, those who are described, not of nature that is described. So in nature, there is no evolution in nature because we create the evolution. And the evolution that does occur in nature varies depending on who the describer is. So evolution can be Lamarckian, or it can be special creationist, or it can be Darwinian, depending on who's doing the describing. Well, I elaborate this example because John Staver is a nice guy, he's a personal friend, he's had very important positions in the international science education community. He writes this stuff, and this stuff is frankly silly, really silly. Unless you become a serious idealist, Bishop Berkeley. If you're a serious idealist, Bishop Berkeley, then this stuff is not silly. But if you're not a real serious idealist, this is just silly. It's nonsense. Why would someone who's clever and smart write such idiotic stuff? Well, this is all a bit of a mystery. Rosalind Driver, another very important science education researcher, lovely woman, sadly died early. Rosalind Driver wrote, "Science as public knowledge is not so much a discovery as a carefully checked construction, and that scientists construct theoretical entities, magnetic fields, genes, electron orbitals, which in turn take on a reality." They don't have reality until scientists construct the concepts. Well, this is ontologically an idealist argument that Rosalind Driver and John Staver and von Glasersfeld and a host of others put forward. What's the argument? The premise, some concept is a human construction. Fine. That's a tautology. All concepts are human constructions. That's a tautology. That's what a concept is. Something that people construct. Conclusion, therefore the reference of the concept does not exist. The first premise, concepts are human constructions, that is, we create the meaning of magnetic field, we create the meaning of evolution by natural selection. What natural selection means, we create the meaning. The conclusion, these concepts have no reference. One only has to state this argument to see that it's an invalid inference, and its validity depends upon making explicit a suppressed premise of the form. Suppressed premise, all concepts that are human constructions can have no existential reference. Well, if you put in that second premise, then you have a valid argument. But the second premise, you've got to look carefully at. The second premise is simply wrong. The suppressed premise is simply dogma for which no evidence is provided. Not only are electron orbitals and magnetic fields human construction, but so also are my house, mountain, table, my wife, and all the other observational terms we use. If the foregoing widespread constructivist argument were valid, then not only would electron orbitals not exist until they're named, neither would our house, our tables, or our garden trees. Well, as I said, those positions are frankly silly, idiotic, and can only be made sensible if you have a really thoroughgoing idealist philosophical position. Well, to just quote one philosophical appraisal of von Glasersfeld. First, much of the, this is by a philosopher sadly now dead, Wallace Suching, who wrote in 1992, now almost 20 years ago, what I myself regard as the most sophisticated criticism of constructivism thus published, and sadly, this most sophisticated criticism of constructivism thus published has more or less never been cited or acknowledged by constructivists, and certainly not by von Glasersfeld in his many subsequent writings. What's Suching's philosophical appraisal of von Glasersfeld? First, much of the doctrine known as constructivism is simply unintelligible. Second, to the extent that it is intelligible, it is simply confused. Third, there is a complete absence of any argument for whatever positions can be made out. In general, far from being what it is claimed to be, namely the new age in philosophy of science, and even slightly perceptively it can detect the familiar voice of a really quite primitive, traditional, subjectivistic empiricism with some overtones of diverse provenance like Piaget and Kuhn. I believe Suching is exactly right here, and just anecdotally, the first time that I ever heard von Glasersfeld Speak, which was at a big NAST conference in the United States maybe 15 or more years ago. He was a plenary speaker, and the audience of whatever, 500 or 600, were, you know, screaming and clapping and stomping their feet and cheering. And I turned to the person alongside me, fellow Brown, David Brown, or I forget his first name, from University of Illinois at the time. And as von Glasersfeld was speaking and everyone was cheering and clapping, I said, "This is just Bishop Berkeley." I said, "This is just Bishop Berkeley." And subsequently, when I got more interested in von Glasersfeld and I saw what impact he was having and I started to read more of his work, he has a nice autobiographical essay about his life. And the biographical essay is interesting because the first thing he states is that he has no training in philosophy. That's interesting. The second thing that he states is that when he went to Ireland during the Second War, he left Italy, went to Ireland during the Second War, that while in Ireland he read Bishop Berkeley. And Bishop Berkeley had made a big impression on him. And he subsequently, von Glasersfeld has subsequently written that 1710 was the greatest year in the history of philosophy. Why? Because in 1710, Bishop Berkeley's Principles of Human Knowledge was published. So my first response during the lecture when everyone was screaming and clapping and cheering was more or less right. Von Glasersfeld's stuff is just Bishop Berkeley. Classic British empiricism and idealism. Variants of constructivist pedagogy. constructivist pedagogy has been given varied names: discovery learning, problem-based learning, inquiry learning, experiential learning, unguided instruction or least guided instruction, different names for constructivist pedagogy. Is it a learning theory or is it an ideology? One might reasonably ask whether ideology is being confused with learning theory. Why must learners construct for themselves the ideas of potential energy, mutation, linear inertia, circular inertia, photosynthesis, valency, and so on? Why must they construct these things? Why not explain these ideas to students and do so in such a way that they understand them? This process may or may not be didactic. It all depends on the classroom circumstance. I'll move quickly on this part of this. It's not what I initially set out to talk about. But does constructivist pedagogy work? The answer is no, it doesn't work. I cite here a colleague who has a room about two along the corridor from me at the University of New South Wales, John Sweller. John Sweller is perhaps Australia's most important empirical researcher in education. He's an educational psychologist. Unlike me, I don't do empirical studies. Sweller's all the time doing empirical studies. He's had something in the order of 40 or 50 PhD students who have all carried on his program of empirical studies of classroom learning. What does Sweller say? The past half century of research on this issue has provided overwhelming and unambiguous evidence that unguided or minimally guided learning is significantly less effective and efficient than guidance that is specifically designed to support the cognitive processing necessary for learning. Not only is minimally guided learning ineffective for most learners, it may even be harmful for some. Continuing with Sweller's article, the best evidence developed over the past half century supports the view that minimally guided learning does not enhance student achievement any more than throwing a non-swimmer out of a boat in the middle of a deep lake supports learning to swim. Richard Mayer, who is president of the American Educational Psychology Association and editor of one of the major journals in the field, I think it's Cognition and Instruction. Richard Mayer published an article, Three Strikes and You're Out. It was a review of the history of discovery learning, and Mayer makes the same claim, namely that learning occurs to the extent that it's guided, and to the extent that it's unguided, it does not occur. Well, I've spent some time on the first theoretical issue, constructivism, and what I hope to have established is that if science educators and curriculum writers and examiners and researchers are sort of thinking and writing about constructivism, then they ought to think a little and read a little about philosophy, because constructivism is inextricably bound up with philosophical positions, specifically epistemological positions and ontological positions. Well, constructivism is just one area. There are many other fields, theoretical issues in science education, where philosophy and education can profitably come together. Multiculturalism. Bill Kyle, another important figure in science education, editor for so many years of the Journal of Research in Science Teaching, now executive secretary of the NAST, National Association for Research and Science Teaching Group, writes, "We have reached a time in society where we can no longer afford to make comparisons between different kinds of knowledge in Western and non-Western cultures. It is simply not productive to raise questions about the status of knowledge. Rather, we must acknowledge that multiple knowledges exist and that it's incumbent upon all cultures to contribute in meaningful ways to the development and environmental sustainability of our global community. We must acknowledge that multiple knowledges exist, and therefore we can't, first that claim, and the second claim, we can't make comparisons." Graham Smith, who was at University of Auckland when I was there in the early 90s and has now become a major figure in international multicultural science education, in multicultural education, both science and outside of it, Graham Smith wrote, "There is a need to struggle to assert the equal validity of Maori knowledge," Maori are the native people of New Zealand, "Maori knowledge and frameworks, and conversely to critically engage ideologies which reify Western knowledge, science, as being superior and more scientific and therefore more legitimate." So people who reify Western science and claim that it's superior, more scientific and therefore more legitimate, those people are ideologues. And Graham Smith and myself were colleagues, and of course Graham believed that I was not so much a philosopher as an ideologue. That's okay. Jajedi, an African science educator, again a person who publishes a great deal and has had a lot of influence in the international community. "In developing new science curriculum materials, the African worldview of nature must form the foundation. The African worldview of nature must form the foundation for science education in Africa. Concepts should be structured in such a way that harmonious coexistence between the Western scientific and the traditional viewpoints are guaranteed." This is a popular position, as people who research multiculturalism, this is a popular position. My own view, as you may guess, is that it's a completely mistaken position, and that there can be no harmonious coexistence between Western scientific and many traditional local knowledges. Let's go on. Multiculturalism and ontology. Matters of ontological contention between, you might say, orthodox Western science and many local knowledges, Maori local knowledge, Australian Aboriginal local knowledge, Brazilian Indian, Amazonian Indian, local knowledge, Inca, local knowledge, Polynesian and Melanesian local knowledges in the Pacific area. There are matters of ontological contention. First, is the world constituted in such a way as to serve human interests? The sort of Western scientific view answers that no. The world is not constituted to serve human interests at all. Most local knowledges, the world is so constituted. I should have looked up, I didn't look it up, but I can't remember. Famous exchange in the, I think, 18th century. Someone asked a person, some famous either theologian or philosopher, why there are 8 hours of darkness each day. And this person replied, well, there are 8 hours of darkness because humans need to sleep. Well, that's a rather nice example that the world is constituted to serve our sleeping interests. Well, the Western scientific view more or less says, hey, not at all. Our processes in the world are teleological. That is, do events and behaviours occur in order to bring about some fitting end state? Again, the bulk of traditional knowledges look at the world in teleological terms. Things happen in order to bring about certain ends. In the Western scientific tradition, more or less from the time of Galileo on, that teleological view of the world has simply been left behind. Third, our inanimate and non-human animate processes activated and controlled by spiritual influences? Again, in the Western scientific tradition, the answer is no. Spiritual influences have... There are no spiritual influences that impact on natural processes. In most local knowledges, there are such spiritual influences. My wife, who lived with Australian Aboriginal community in the far north of Australia for some 5 years, their world was just absolutely populated with spirits. So when someone dies, in the Western, more or less Western scientific tradition, if you're walking along and die, there's an autopsy, and you know, do you have embolism in the brain, has your liver rupture, do you have a collapsed lung? Well, in that Australian Aboriginal community, if someone walks along the street and dies, they don't do that. They look for spirits. Who cast a spell? The person died because someone cast a spell. They wouldn't think of doing an autopsy. They go looking, who cast the spell? And that's an absolute commonplace. So what I'm saying here is that ontologically, there's simply a big clash between local knowledge and Western scientific knowledge. And epistemologically, likewise, there are clashes. Does knowledge come from observation of things as they are in their natural state? Well, for most local knowledges, yes. We gain knowledge by looking at things in their natural state. Well, the Western scientific tradition more or less says, no, not at all. The only way to gain knowledge is to experiment on things, to manipulate things, not to look at them. And I should have again put up a slide for this, the famous case of Galileo's study of free fall. People for thousands of years had been looking at free fall, bodies falling in their natural state, falling a little way and falling a long way. Did they gain knowledge of this? Absolutely not at all. No knowledge of falling bodies. Until Galileo hit on the very bright idea of using an inclined plane. So, sorry, I don't have slides for this. Instead of just the ball dropping, he had a long inclined plane, and he rolled the ball along the plane, and that terribly sort of brilliant, insightful step that Galileo made of having moving a bell down the plane until he got, and the ball passed over a little lever that hit the bell, and he moved the levers until he got ding, 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 ding. That is, by his ear, he was able to measure or to recognise regular time intervals. Ding, 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 ding. Regular time intervals. And then he looked at his inclined plane and he saw that the distance was the distance travelled by the ball was the square of the time. Brilliant. But you only know that by experimenting, not by just looking at falling objects. Yeah. Go on. A knowledge claims validated by successful predictions overwhelmingly in local knowledge is yes. If your prediction comes true, then your claim is justified. In Western science, no. Do particular classes or authority figures define knowledge or become the custodians of knowledge? Again, in most local, traditional societies, yes. There are groups that have the knowledge and other groups that don't have the knowledge. In Australian Aboriginal community, there's men's knowledge and there's women's knowledge. Men can't have women's knowledge. That's special women's business. Women can't have men's knowledge. That's special men's business. And among the men, there are special groups of people who are the custodians of special knowledge. The Western tradition, more or less, is, at least in principle, absolutely democratic. Knowledge is democratic, public. Women can have it, men can have it, you know. Old people can have it, young people can have it, etc. That's a very different story than what you get in most traditional cultures. Is knowledge a fixed and unchanging system? Again, in most local cultures, the answer to that is yes. The knowledge has been passed down from generation to generation. In the Western tradition, knowledge is not fixed and unchanging. Well, the again, what I'm just wanting to say here about multiculturalism is that once you start to read multicultural science education stuff, you very quickly come across philosophical positions being asserted, and my claim, as with all of these things, is that those positions really, to be intelligently discussed, the science teacher and the science educator need some familiarity with philosophy. Worldviews, another area where another area where philosophy and science education come into contact. If you look at science education literature, you will see many references to worldviews and science teaching, worldviews and the learning of science. These have been, you might say, put very publicly before educators and teachers last year, which was celebrating the Darwin Centenary years, because people were writing everywhere that there's a clash of worldview between the Darwinian view of the world and many other views of the world, many student views of the world, and it was that clash of worldviews which was inhibiting the learning of evolutionary theory. Well, much is written on it. I myself have edited a book just recently, Science, Worldviews and Education. cover of which is there, and I think it's something that was handed out to you. It's available for sale, $25. I should say cheap at double the price, but I won't. What are the worldview components? Ontological, epistemological, ethical, religious, or irreligious? Worldviews, if you speak about someone's worldview, you're talking about an amalgam of things which, if you sort of separate them out, you find ontological positions, epistemological, ontological meaning what things exist in the world. Ontology is what kinds of things exist in the world. Epistemological, how do we know things about the world? Ethical and religious, or in brackets, irreligious. Worldviews contain ideas of what entities exist in the world, matter, spirits, minds, angels, and ideas about the powers and actions of such putative entities. A worldview encompasses ideas of nature, its constitution, origins and purposes, if any, ideas about placing nature in the general scheme of things, ideas of God and how God may or may not interact with the world, including answering prayers, performing miracles, making revelations and anointing prophets and messengers. Worldviews entail ideas of the sacred, ideas of how knowledge is acquired and tested, ideas of the goodness or badness of human nature. Well, worldviews and popular belief. In the United States, the American Gallup poll has consistently shown that for the past 30 years, almost half of the American population agree with the statement God created human beings pretty much in their present form at one time within the last 10,000 years or so. More or less half the population believe that. And America is the most educated country in the world in the sense of, you know, the greatest number of people complete high school, the greatest number of people complete university, and so on. So despite this enormous effort put into education, consistently for 30 years, the Gallup poll shows that almost half of Americans believe that statement which is on the slide. That statement happens to be false. Why do they believe it? They believe it because it somehow coheres with their worldview. In 2008, the Pew poll had much the same. 42% of the population, this is a big poll done in America, 42% of the population believing that life on Earth existed in its present form since the beginning of time. I have seen work done on comparable belief in the Turkish population. I should have pulled that work out and put it on the slide. I forgot to do so. But the figures in Turkey are much the same as in the United States, except my memory is they're worse than in the United States. And again, you know, why is such a large portion of the Turkish population and the American population believing things that are blatantly false? Why do they believe blatantly false things? Because this coheres with their worldview. Well, this brings up questions of what does education do about worldviews? Does it have any connection with worldviews? Should it have any connection with worldviews? A distinction that's sort of useful to make is between teaching for scientific competence and teaching for a scientific outlook. An example, Edgar Mitchell, the NASA astronaut who during 1971, the Apollo 14 mission, made the longest ever spacewalk. He was walking around in space for 117 days or something. Mitchell has impeccable scientific training, education, two bachelor degrees in science, a degree in, I think, physics and one in mathematics from universities in California, the best California universities. He has a doctoral degree in aeronautical engineering from MIT, in the best of all the American technical universities. But, surprise, surprise, despite having impeccable scientific training, Mitchell believes in extrasensory perception. Gives talks about it, gives interviews about it. He believes in UFOs, he believes that spaceships have come down to America and, you know, spacemen and women have gotten out and gone to the local McDonald's store in Nevada and, you know, had a McDonald's and decided this was no good for them and, you know, went back to wherever they come from.
Did they like it?
Yeah, no, they went back. He believes that he was cured of kidney cancer over the telephone. He sent money to Adam Dreamhealer in Canada and paid Adam Dreamhealer money and held the telephone against his kidney, and Adam Dreamhealer, you know, chanted something, and his kidney cancer was cured. And he talks regularly with his long dead father, utilising some medium. Oh, hi Dad, you know, I'm having a great day the other day, and we went here for the weekend, and I hope you're, you know, everything's going fine for you, you know, up there in heaven or wherever you are. Well, again, frankly, these ideas are simply, you only have to say them, you know, they're simply idiotic. Idiotic. False. Wrong. The question is, he has an absolute marvellous science training. His scientific competence is impeccable. You know, he can solve differential equations faster than you can write them out for you. Well, what do we make of this? What we make of it is that he's had an education which has stressed scientific competence, scientific ability. And he's done very well at it. But that education has been purely technical. You might say narrow, technical, but excellent. And the issue for science educators and for curriculum writers, of course, is do we want to develop scientific competence in our students alone, or do we want to develop scientific competence and, let's say, scientific outlook or habit of mind? I'll come back to that. Worldviews in the classroom. The AAAS, American Association for the Advancement of Science, wrote the teaching of science must explore the interplay between science and intellectual and cultural traditions in which it is firmly embedded. Science has a history that can demonstrate the relationship between science and the wider world of ideas and can illuminate contemporary issues. So AAAS is saying, no, when we teach science, we shouldn't just be teaching scientific competence. We want children to understand the relationship between science and the wider world of ideas, between science and culture. Let me go back just to elaborate this one bit. This idea that science should elaborate the connection between science and culture, or develop scientific outlook, or the AAAS elsewhere calls it scientific habit of mind. Nehru, the founding president of India, called it scientific temper. This idea is the Enlightenment idea. This is the idea that flowed, had its origins in the Western Enlightenment. The Enlightenment philosophers of the West who followed and looked to the scientific revolution for their inspiration, the work of Boyle, Huygens, Newton, Galileo. The Enlightenment philosophers, the English ones, Hume, Locke, Priestley, the French Enlightenment philosophers, Diderot, Humbert, the German philosophers, Kant, all of these people thought that the point of learning science and teaching science was that science would flow over into the wider culture and help make the wider culture better, make it, you know, less superstitious, make it less authoritarian, make it more open, make it more critical, make it more prepared to examine entrenched cultural practices, and so on. That's the Enlightenment tradition. And John Dewey is part of that, Nehru, and the AAAS are sort of saying the same thing. Well, I've indicated just briefly that there are clashes between the scientific, let's say, worldview and many other worldviews. Clashes between the scientific worldview and many religious worldviews. Clashes between the scientific worldview and many cultural practices, you know, astrology, as an example, but many other things. Well, how do you reconcile these clashes? Jay Adey mentioned about teaching science. When you teach science in Africa, you have to recognize and adopt the African worldview. Well, if the African worldview is inconsistent with science, how do you sort of harmoniously, how do you make them harmonious? Seems to me that historically there have been four sort of ways of making them harmonious. First, to say that science really has no metaphysics, that science makes no metaphysical claims. This is the option made famous by the Catholic positivist philosopher and scientist Pierre Dume. Science just deals with appearances. Just deals with appearances. Scientific theories tell us nothing about any deep reality. Scientific theories just tell us how this thing connects or otherwise with this thing. That links observables. Makes no claims about the world. So scientific theories making, if science is making no deep claims about the world, then it's consistent with all conceivable views that do make deep claims. Astrology and varied religions and varied cultural groups and so on. Second option, the metaphysics of science is false. It's false. Therefore, there can be no conflict. Why? Because this metaphysics is true, the scientific one is false. That gets rid of the conflict. That's the option advocated by many in the scholastic tradition in the West, the Roman Catholic scholastic tradition, philosophical theologians, and it's advocated by many contemporary Islamic scholars. Again, I should have pulled out some slides and put up here, but very Islamic scholars are simply saying that the metaphysics of science is false. The scientific view of the world is wrong. And if you believe that, then you can have an alternate Islamic view of the world, which then is not inconsistent. The third option is to say there can be parallel, equally valid metaphysics. This is an old, this is sort of the coexistence view. This is an old option given recent prominence by Stephen Jay Gould in his book, The God of Ages, his Noma formulation, Gould's non-overlapping magisterial authority. Gould says, well, we've just got equally valid metaphysics parallel to each other. And the fourth option is to say that there's a fundamental disagreement among philosophers of science about metaphysics, and while the philosophers of science can't work out among themselves what the metaphysics of science is, then anyone else can, you know, believe what they want. And when you get your house in order, you know, come and tell us, and then we will reconcile or not reconcile our own view. But while you guys are and women are, you know, quarrelling among yourselves about philosophy of science, we'll just, you know, go to Adam Dream here with a clairvoyant, or we'll, you know, go to the astrologer, or we'll do whatever we want. A significant part of the scientific worldview is the scientific outlook or habit of mind. It's been called by Popper and others the critical spirit. a preparedness to put all questions on the table for serious and critical examination. This was the spirit of inquiry rekindled in the Western world with the scientific revolution, codified and championed by the Enlightenment. Nehru wrote the promotion of scientific temper into the Indian constitution. When the state of India was formed, the independent state of India was formed in 1949, Nehru wrote into the constitution that the government will promote scientific temper, scientific, what's called habit of mind or scientific outlook, because Nehru believed that the deep-seated cultural problems of India could only be solved if people had a scientific way of sort of looking at the world. So scientific temper was written into the Indian constitution. In Japan, they used the term scientific rationalism until in the late 30s they realised that scientific rationalism was going to impede Japanese expansion in Asia and was going to, dissolve Japanese beliefs in the powers of the emperor. So scientific rationalism was abandoned in Japan. On these things, the work of Mario Bunge I find most useful myself. I will just go over this diagram for you. Bunge is a philosopher of science, had his 90th birthday just about 2 months ago. He was originally a physicist from Argentina, worked in quantum physics, and then became a philosopher and has written scores and scores of books and hundreds of articles in philosophy. And he's having an article published in the journal that I edit, Science and Education, early next year. And in that article on science and pseudoscience, he has a rather nice diagram. I won't elaborate it too much, but Bunge is saying that science requires an intellectual ecology, an intellectual environment or a cultural environment in order to be healthy, in order to sustain itself, in order to progress. We're aware that it requires a physical environment, money for laboratories, equipment, buildings, enormously expensive technologies, you know, all of that are the material circumstances that science requires, including, of course, the production of scientific workers. But apart from material production, Bunge is saying it requires a sort of an intellectual cultural environment, the elements of which are, it's first, humanism, that science ought to be for the governed by human concerns, human welfare, human interests, in contrast to commercial interests. If commercial interests govern science, then you don't get healthy and good science. You get science that serves the interests of oil companies or tobacco companies or whatever. Systematism, that science requires people to think systematically, not compartmentally. That what you're doing in psychology has to be informed by or make connections with what people are doing in neurology. That what you do in organic chemistry has to connect with what's being done in inorganic chemistry. And that the degree to which people are fractured or fractionated, then that is bad for the development of science. Bunge, of course, believes in materialism, that a culture has to be materialist or naturalist for science to develop. That Australian Aboriginal community I spoke about will have no science, can have no science, because it doesn't look in the right places. It's distracted by immaterialist beliefs about the action of spirits. And if you think earthquakes and the like are caused, and tidal waves are caused by spirits, then you're not going to look scientifically in the right place. realism, scientism. Scientism is the view that the scientific method ought to be applied in social science and psychology and so on. I won't elaborate that anymore, except to say I find myself that that's a very useful sort of picture of the intellectual, cultural requirements for the growth of science. Models I won't elaborate at all. Anyone reading stuff in science education and looking at textbooks will see that, you know, models are just everywhere in science. The question raised by children is, are we learning about models or are we learning about the world? And that's the philosophical issue, namely, how do our models in economics or our models in sociology or our models in organic chemistry, how do those models relate or don't relate to the world? And that's a philosophical issue that philosophers writing on model theory spend a lot of time on, and consequently, again, the general claim, science teachers and science educators would be helped by reading that literature. Ethics, again, many, many questions arise in the science classroom and in the conduct of science of an ethical kind. Most universities have got ethical committees. You can't, at my university, you can't even think of doing any research that in any way touches anybody or any animal without your research passing an ethical committee. That's now commonplace. Many university programs have got compulsory ethics courses. At my university, you can't graduate as an engineer unless you pass the course on ethics and engineering. You can't graduate now as an accountant unless you pass the course on ethical accounting. That might, you know, seem like an oxymoron to many people. But these are now realities. The Human Genome Project has 3% of its budget, $90 million, $90 million are allocated to ethical and legal ramifications of the Human Genome Project. Well, and these ethical questions are not just big ones about the conduct of science, but they're questions that come up in science classrooms raised by children. And again, the point here is that science teachers, if they're surrounded by all of these ethical questions, should go to philosophy and begin to read a little bit about what ethicists write about ethics. Well, I've said three areas of application: theoretical issues I've been dealing with, curriculum construction, and thirdly, pedagogical application. Curriculum construction, I hesitate to even elaborate these. Long-standing tension between three purposes or goals of science education. One, cultural, better understanding of past and present society. Second, applied, how to function in a technological world. Disciplinary, training for university science. Cultural, applied and disciplinary goals need not be inconsistent. You don't have to choose one or the other or the other. You can have all three, but if you want to have all three, then again, you need history and philosophy of science to show you somehow the connections, and I will elaborate that. I won't bother. Nature of Science is written into curriculum everywhere, the dreaded NOS. What is Nature of Science? It consists of methodology, epistemology, ontology, ethics, and history. How does science develop or change? How do scientific theories change? And if you're writing about NOS, then you've got to write about or think about or teach about each of those things. And they're all matters that historians and philosophers of science concern themselves with. The famous or infamous Lederman 7. Norm Lederman, Storming Norm. Norm's list of NOS items, all seven. To put it briefly, my own view is that we should think not so much of nature of science as features of science. Science has got many, many features of all different kinds, and it's those features of science that one should be thinking about and listing out. In addition to the 11 and 7, one can, for instance, easily just keep adding. What are the demarcation criteria that separate science from non-science? That's an important matter concerning the nature of science. What's distinctive or otherwise about the methodology of science? What are the characteristics of proper scientific explanation? Are there rational grounds for choice between competing theories? Is science to be understood in an instrumentalist or a realist way? What's the role